ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। हरिः ॐ। द इन्विसिबल् इस् द इन्फिनिट्, द विसिबल् टु इस् द इन्फिनिट्, फ्रम् द इन्फिनिट् the visible universe of infinite extension has come out. The infinite remains the same, even though the infinite universe has come out of it. Om peace, peace, peace. Let's meditate for a few minutes on the infinite. Now the subject before me is psychology in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. When we use this word psychology, sometimes we have in mind psychology as an academic topic, say the science focusing on the study of human mind, human behavior, human activities, the normal and abnormal characteristics of human mind. But what I mean here, I mean by the word psychology in relation to the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, is slightly different. The psychological approach, or rather Sri Ramakrishna's approach in solving the spiritual problems of modern man, how he approaches spiritual aspirants of different temperaments in their journey, in their spiritual journey towards the ultimate goal of realization of God. That's what I have in mind. Now, if you read the Gospel, what strikes you as its unique characteristic is that Sri Ramakrishna doesn't reject anyone. His doors are always open to everyone, not only to believers, even to those who don't believe in God. If you read the Gospel, you'll find Sri Ramakrishna sitting in the small room at Dakshineswar temple, surrounded by people who belong to all walks of life. There are believers, there are non-believers, there are theists, atheists, agnostics, people belonging to different denominations of Hindu tradition, people who belong to different religious groups. There are Hindus, Christians, Muslims, Sikhs, and so on. And all of them go back receiving something from Sri Ramakrishna. In fact, one important distinction of Sri Ramakrishna's Gospel as a religious scripture is perhaps this, to the best of my knowledge. If you compare the Gospel with the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, or the Bible, or the Quran, or any other religious scriptures, there is something unique about Gospel, and that's what I mentioned earlier. All religious scriptures, whether of Hindus or Christians or Muslims or Jews or Sikhs, whoever may be, they're addressed to people who follow that particular religious tradition. And again, it addresses the problems of those who believe in God or some kind or other. But Sri Ramakrishna doesn't directly address any particular religious faith system or anybody belonging to any particular religion or group. He addresses the entire mankind as a whole. So the most unique characteristic of gospel is its essential humanism and its accessibility to people of all walks of life. Harmony, synthesis, and an essentially positive approach. You find sometimes drunkards also sitting in front of Sri Ramakrishna. People who led a kind of profligate life, like Girishchandra Ghosh, who was the greatest dramatist of that time, that age. There are people who will come to Dakshineswar but will not go to the temple, the Kali. They will not go and bow down before the image in the temple. But they will straight away come to Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna doesn't tell them, you first go to the temple and worship, then come here. He doesn't say. He talks to them also. But slowly, after some time, they will become believers. Perhaps one of the greatest of Sri Ramakrishna's householder disciples, maybe the greatest, was Keshav Chandra Sen, the founder of Brahma Samaj. He was the one who didn't go to the temple, who won't bow down before any saint or incarnation, and who didn't believe any kind of established religions. Brahma Samaj was actually a hodgepodge of Unitarian Church, Vedic religion, a kind of pantheistic Vedic religion, and also some kind of modern humanistic ideas. That is what Brahma Samaj stood for. And Keshav Chandra Sen was this greatest exponent of that time. After Rajaram Mohan Roy, who was its founder, Keshav Chandra Sen was perhaps the most prominent among the exponents of Brahma Samaj's philosophy. He also found a place in Sri Ramakrishna's room. And the great spiritual personalities who later interpreted Vedic religion in the language of modern man, like Swami Vivekananda. He also found a place in Sri Ramakrishna's room. So maybe the most essential characteristic of Sri Ramakrishna's message is its accessibility, its essential humanism, and again, its harmonizing, reconciling, synthesizing approach towards not only religious beliefs and philosophies, but also different ways of life. Students of Indian philosophy, Indian spiritual philosophy, religious philosophy, will find something striking in Sri Ramakrishna's message. So also, students of world religions also you find. I shall just give a few highlights into this essential nature of reconciliation and harmony in Sri Ramakrishna's message. Now, you know, those who specialize in Indian philosophy would know there have been many philosophers and saints belonging to the three prominent schools of Vedanta philosophy, namely Dvaitva, that is dualism, Visishtadvaita, which is qualified non-dualism, and Advaita, non-dualism. Now, there was a prolonged dialectical and polemical warfare between Dvaitins, Visishtadvaitins, and Advaitins. It almost extended for a period of nearly 700 years, right from 9th century or 8th century up to, say, about 16th century till the period of Madhusudana Saraswati. Almost for 700, 800 years, there was a prolonged dialectical and polemical warfare between different schools of Vedanta in India. So ultimately, we come to a conclusion that there can be no reconciliation. There can be no reconciliation, no harmony at the philosophical level, at the dialectical level, at the polemical level. Because each dialectician put forward his own ideas, his own arguments, and they will be refuted by some other dialecticians belonging to the rival school. So it went on till about 16th century. Then it slowly, maybe about 17th century, then slowly it faded with the emergence of bhakti movement, devotional movements beginning with Tulasidas and others, Chaitanya and others. What I am trying to drive home is this. Sri Ramakrishna says that this harmony, this reconciliation between different approaches to God or between different interpretations of the fundamental principles of religion can be achieved only at the experience level. Because from the experience level, if you look, you find all religions, all religious philosophies are only different attempts to explain experience. And experience can never be explained. Experience can only be experienced, Sri Ramakrishna himself says. We cannot even define or describe the sweetness of sugar, which is a very, very empirical, a very, very physical experience. Then what to speak of the transcendental experience? It's a famous book translated from German into English by Peter Townsend, The Transcendental Unity of Religions. The author is Fritz von Schaun. He speaks of the transcendental unity of religions. This transcendental unity can be achieved only at the experience level, because experience transcends all words, all philosophies, all definitions and descriptions. Again, I'm coming back to 19th century India, because I should give you an idea, a background of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, how it emerged as a unique gospel. In 19th century, there have been many attempts to give a compact, a harmonious philosophy of spiritual life. There have been many reform movements within Hindu tradition, which tried to weed out some of the cobwebs, some of the undesirable trends which had crept into Hindu religion and Hindu social life, like casteism, untouchability, the wide gap between the poor and rich, and a lot of social injustices which have slowly, gradually crept into Hindu religious body politic over the preceding 3,000, 4,000 years, which is a very ancient religion, and it never had a founder as such. It was a religion based on the spiritual experiences of great saints and sages. So naturally, it had a lot of scope for varied interpretations and varied approaches towards the ultimate goal. So Brahma Samaj was the first of those reform movements. It was founded in the year 1828. Its founder was Rajaram Mohan Roy. And he was influenced by many religious ideas of Christianity and Islam, and also by some of the ideas of reform which he got from French Revolution and also from different socio-political movements which had their origin in Europe and America. You know, when Indians came in contact with English education, they also came in contact with certain ideas like liberalism, equality, justice for all, and such ideas which influenced some of the revolutionary movements and some of the independent struggle movements of Europe and America. When they read the French Revolution, they were naturally, they became acquainted with the teachings of Robespierre, Rousseau, Voltaire, and others, which gave the intellectual shape to what we later became French Revolution. Later it became an anarchy and bloodshed. That's a different part of history. But in the beginning, French Revolution was influenced by many such ideas: liberalism, equality, justice, fraternity, and so on. Again, when they read about the war between the independent struggle between the 13 colonies of America and British Crown, that also influenced many Indians who had access to English education. This was even before the English education was formally introduced in India in 1836, after Macaulay's Minutes became the official document for introducing English education in India. So people naturally came aware of the social injustices which had crept into society, Indian society as a whole. You have to remember, Indian society is a very, very ancient society, and the civilization is so ancient. Modern historians have put it they consider it as much more antique, much more ancient than Egyptian, Sumerian, or Babylonian civilizations. So we have to think of a civilization which is several millennia old, which had already reached its zenith of perfection thousands of years before the birth of Christ. So naturally, a lot of social, undesirable social trends crept into Indian society. So Rajaram Mohan Roy's Brahma Samaj was the first attempt to weed out some of these injustices which had crept into Indian society. The second movement was Arya Samaj. And it was founded by a great sannyasi, Dayananda Saraswati. The third one was Theosophical movement, which had its origin outside India, but which became popular in India. It was founded by Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott, but Annie Besant, who was a British educationist before she came to India, she was the exponent of this reform movement. What I'm trying to drive home is the background of the emergence of gospel as a unique religious scripture from Indian point of view. Later I will try to approach it from the Western point of view. Now, Brahma Samaj made one very serious mistake. It rejected the fundamental principles of Hindu religion. So it completely rejected temple worship, which is the beginning, which is the first step in a man's spiritual journey. It also rejected the highest metaphysical spiritual ideal of Vedic philosophy, namely Advaita. So it rejected the tail and also rejected the head. So what was left was a lifeless torso. So naturally, it died a natural death. Practically, it became non-existent by the time Sri Ramakrishna's life came to an end. And its most prominent teacher during Sri Ramakrishna's lifetime was Keshava Chandra Sen. He came to the Dakshineswar as a very prominent man. He was the greatest celebrity of Calcutta elite at that time. And he went back as a humble devotee of mother. So Sri Ramakrishna brought about a complete revolution in the mindset of the greatest intellectual of that time, namely Keshava Chandra Sen. Then Arya Samaj. Arya Samaj was a highly conservative attempt to reform Hinduism. Brahma Samaj was described by Annie Besant as Keshav's attempt to Christianize Hinduism from within, and Arya Samaj, on the other hand, was described as an attempt to go back to the pre-Buddhist period, because Arya Samaj tried to revive the old ritualistic philosophy of Vedic religion, and it also became slowly non-existent or irrelevant. Theosophical movement was a kind of occult philosophy. It derived much of its teachings from the occult teachings of Tibetan Buddhism, and it didn't find many followers in India. It also practically became irrelevant. So what I want to say, now Sri Ramakrishna comes forward with a distinct and different message in this context. He never rejects anything. What he says is, everyone has a place in religious, spiritual life. If an aspirant is sincere, honest, truthful, and in Sri Ramakrishna's own language, sincere yearning for realizing God, he will reach his destination. Truth is one, whatever it may be called, but it can be approached from different angles and it can be interpreted in different languages. There can be as many paths as there are aspirants. The ancient Vedic teaching, Ekam Sat Vipra Bhagudha Vadanti, was given a new interpretation, but it is not a new, but then a very simplified interpretation in Sri Ramakrishna's language. He said, you may call water by the name water, that's an English word, or you may call it by another name in Jalam, it is Sanskrit language, Sanskrit word, and you could be called by any name, but water remains water. Similarly, God or spiritual experience can be called and approached from different angles depending upon the temperament of the aspirant. But God opens his doors and windows to everyone if the aspirant is sincere and honest. That is Sri Ramakrishna's interpretation. Now, here, approaching from universe from Western angle, we can just think of the scene of 19th century. After the publication of Karl Marx, Das Kapital, after the teachings, after the ideas of Communist Manifesto became popular, after the publication of Darwin's Original Species, and after the teachings of neo-positivist philosophers became prominent in many Western universities, religion practically lost its relevance. A religion which interprets itself in terms of a place of worship, a dogmatic interpretation of a scripture, and which insists that you can approach God only through the medium of a priest or a preacher or whoever may be. That kind of religion is not, in the language of Esrapon, is an unnecessary luxury for modern man. It is no more acceptable to intelligent, educated people living in the age of science and technology. So naturally, religion was in danger of dying an unnatural, premature death, because religion came to be interpreted as anti-humanistic. It came to be interpreted as unscientific and not acceptable to science and technology. It came to be interpreted as a dogmatic philosophy which closes its doors and windows to certain people and opens its doors and windows to certain other people. That means it propagated a God which divides mankind into two conflicting groups, mutually fighting groups of believers on the one hand and non-believers on the other. The believers have access to heaven, non-believers are straight away going to hell. This kind of religion has no place in modern man's life. This was the approach, this was the intellectual climate which prevailed in America when Swamiji came here in 1893. So, a parliament of religion was included as an important part of the Columbian Exposition with a view to give a new life to religion which was almost on the verge of dying a premature death. So Swamiji came here with a new interpretation of religion based on the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna which are enshrined in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Today everyone knows about Swamiji as a great speaker, as a great prophet of modern age, but Swamiji got all this from the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. Sister Niveda writes that Swamiji's teachings are influenced by three streams. One, and the most important one, was the training he received under Sri Ramakrishna from 1881 to 1886, the year in which Sri Ramakrishna passed away. The second part was his modern and Sanskrit education. The third one, of course, the experience which he had during his travels as a wanderer in India, and his sense of justice, social justice, and his eagerness to bring about a reform in Vedantic or the traditional ancient Hindu religion. But the most important part of Swamiji's training was the training which he received from Sri Ramakrishna during his visits to Dakshineswar from 1881 to 1886. 1986. So what I want to say, what Swamiji gave us was nothing but an intellectual interpretation of the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, which he gave in simple rustic language, of the language which was prevalent in the village where he was born in Kamarpuku in 1836. So the uniqueness of gospel as a scripture is that it keeps its doors and windows open to all. It is accessible to all. Again, he is essentially humane. He doesn't reject all. And again, it doesn't divide mankind into believers and non-believers. He reconciles, on the one hand, all the denominations prevailing in popular Hinduism of that time. At the same time, it also reconciles science and technology on the one hand, spirituality on the other. The great cultural values of Western civilization on the one hand, and the spiritual values of the Orient on the other. The modern and the ancient, the traditional, and also the modern Western scientific culture. This fusion, this harmonious blending is perhaps the most unique aspect of Sri Ramakrishna's teachings enshrined in the gospel. I shall read out a few important parts from the gospel that will give us an insight into how he approached different spiritual aspirants and how he tried to address their spiritual problems. Some of the teachings are very unique. Some of our popular beliefs and conventional belief systems which we normally entertain are given a new approach and new interpretation, spiritual interpretation by Sri Ramakrishna. Here, you know, there is a Sri Ramakrishna says, about Sri Ramakrishna, one great author says, he despised all these metaphysical subtleties and hair-splitting arguments. The one thing needful, according to him, was the intensity of yearning for God, an intense desire for spiritual enlightenment. If this intense, sincere desire for spiritual enlightenment is present, then anyone, no matter what religion he professed, what culture he practiced, or what language he spoke, he can attain God in his own way. So the only true medium for spiritual enlightenment is a sincere aspiration for the realization of God. You may not believe in the existence of Krishna, Jesus, or Buddha, but you must have the love of a true aspirant. You may not believe in the different historical figures of popular scriptures like Ramayana and Mahabharata, but you must have the sincere feelings of a true devotee. And always your love of God is more important than your theoretical knowledge of God. So this sincere aspiration for spiritual enlightenment is possible for all. You need not believe even in a particular religion or in one well-defined concept of God. If a man is sincere and honest and truthful, then God opens his doors in front of you. He doesn't bother whether you actually accept him or not. So God doesn't even demand that you should accept him first and then follow a well-structured path. You should open your heart, then God opens his doors. That is Sri Ramakrishna's interpretation. A very, very universal interpretation. It can be applicable to anyone living anywhere in the world. Even an atheist can follow Sri Ramakrishna's religion. That is the beauty and uniqueness of it. He says, your love of God is more important than your theoretical knowledge of God. One need not believe, one need not begin with a confession or with a profession of a faith in Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, or any religion. Because you can never love God and hate His children. So, as Swamiji interpreting this particular teaching of Sri Ramakrishna says elsewhere in the Practical Vedanta, he says, the greatest act of worship is the worship of the man living next door to you. And he says, because man is the Taj Mahal of temples. Taj Mahal is supposed to be a very beautiful, the most beautiful building in the world, perhaps. At least it is the symbol of architectural beauty. So man is the most beautiful temple. That man may belong to any religion, any culture, any part of the world. So humanism is the greatest, rather spiritual humanism is the greatest interpretation and definition of religion. This is so universal. So any Christian, any Hindu, or any Muslim, no matter what religion he practices, can be spiritual if he is truly a human being. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. When you go into a mango grove, you should eat the sweet fruit and not go about counting the leaves of all the trees. Sri Ramakrishna doesn't speak from the standpoint of a philosopher or a metaphysician or a theologian or a theoretician. He speaks from the standpoint of a humble devotee of God. Now, if a devotee opens his heart, then God opens his doors. God is not very particular that you should know all about his characteristics, whether he is form, with form, without form, whether he should be interpreted in this manner or in any different manner. He doesn't bother. God only looks at your heart. As in the old Sanskrit dictum, it means bhavagrahi janardhanaha. I mean, Janardana means God. He's one of the names, synonyms of God. He looks at your attitude. He looks deep into your heart. He doesn't look into your brain or the books you have written. He sees he sees if your heart is open, then he opens his doors. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. When a jug of water from a tank is able to quench your thirst, why do you worry yourself about the exact quantity of water in the tank? Now, Sri Ramakrishna is addressing those people who are too intellectual. I mean, who are too much bothered about different denominations of God, different definitions of God. Sri Ramakrishna says, of course, we have to remember, he is addressing a sincere devotee. Sri Ramakrishna doesn't deprecate or he doesn't belittle scriptural learning or philosophical dialectical teaching. He doesn't belittle anything. And in another context, Sri Ramakrishna would say, a teacher may need all this. A teacher may require philosophical doctrines. He may require metaphysical training. He may require many such tools with which alone he will be able to put the ideas of spirituality and religion and God into aspirants' minds. Because there are many people who can approach even the subject of spirituality from the intellectual point of view. Such people may naturally require intellectual training. So Sri Ramakrishna, who says that intellectual training or theoretical knowledge are not necessary for spiritual enlightenment, was also a great admirer of Vivekananda. At that time, Swami Vivekananda was known as Narendranath Dutta, a highly gifted intellectual young man who was steeped in Western and Oriental systems of thought. Sri Ramakrishna highly appreciated him. And in fact, in front of other students, other devotees, Sri Ramakrishna used to praise Narendra. See, look at him. He is a well-read man. He is a brilliant young man. He could sing and he had so many other skills. Either Sri Ramakrishna used to admire him. So Sri Ramakrishna did not belittle intellectual learning or anything. We should not get away with that impression. What he drives home is that even without theoretical knowledge, even without metaphysical training, if a man's heart is sincere, God's door opens before him. That's what Sri Ramakrishna emphasizes. Again, in another context, Sri Ramakrishna says, there are some people who tell you, we need not worry about devotion or anything. Just do good to others, social work, philanthropic activities. This is enough. We need not worry about worship, prayer, meditation. So addressing such devotees, such aspirants, Sri Ramakrishna says. In fact, he quotes one such devotee. Sir, this kind of renunciation has almost ruined this country. For this reason, our country is very poor today. Doing good to others, bringing education to the door of the ignorant, and above all, improving the material condition of the country. This should be our duty now. The cry of religion and renunciation, spiritual realization, God realization, these things are contrary to the material progress of the nation. You should advise the young men of this country to resort to such acts only as will uplift the nation. But the Sri Ramakrishna is quoting the views of a particular group of people. These good young people of those days. Now they were complaining that too much of obsession with spiritual ideas like renunciation, etc., will be detrimental to the material progress of a nation. So we must focus on social work, philanthropical work, industrialization. These are the ideas which were prevalent among certain educated people of that age. Sri Ramakrishna is referring to that. He says, you appear to be a man of poor understanding. You dare to slight in these terms a thing which all of scriptures describe as the greatest of all virtues. By reading 2 pages of English, remember, Sri Ramakrishna has nothing against English. I mean, it's a symbolic reference to certain quasi-intellectuals, sham intellectuals, who may have got little modern education, so think everything related to religion and spirituality are absolutely useless. Let us now bring Western culture, Western education, Western technology, and let us remove the traces of our traditional spiritual values. Such people were there were many such people advocating this philosophy of life in Calcutta at that time. Sri Ramakrishna is referring to that. So he says, you seem to think that you are omniscient. How do you dare talk of helping the world? The Lord will look to it. You have not got the power in you to do it. Can you explain to me how you can work for others? Sri Ramakrishna is referring to certain people, you know, let us reform the world, let us help the world. The world is suffering, so let us go and save this world. He's referring to those people. But at the same time, Sri Ramakrishna himself advocated a great philosophy of philanthropy. In fact, Swamiji's ideas of national regeneration, the importance of material progress, Swamiji's practical Vedanta, all these ideas originated in Sri Ramakrishna's teaching. They had their origin in Sri Ramakrishna's teachings. Sri Ramakrishna himself was a great advocate of the idea of philanthropical activities, charitable activities, and also the need to help others who are in need of material things, in fact. He was not opposed to philanthropy. What Sri Ramakrishna says is this: people who think that we need not worry about spiritual values, we can save the world, we can improve the conditions of the world, think that the world is so small that it stands in need of your help. You are so big and world so small. So world now stands in need of your help so that it can live better tomorrow. He condemns such people. He only condemns the egotistic attitude. Because you have to remember another scene in Dakshineshwar. When Sri Ramakrishna preached, when he taught, that we must not have, uh, that we must have a religion which helps mankind, not only in spiritual life, but also material life. Some of the ideas which Swamiji preached later, when Swamiji says, I don't care for a God who keeps men miserable in this world and gives heaven after his death. I don't care for such a religion, Swamiji says in one context. Now, Swamiji got this idea from Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna was one day visiting a famous temple in Bihar called Vaidyanath, maybe a few hundreds of kilometers away from Dakshineswar. Before entering the temple, he found there were a number of beggars squatting around the temple. Poverty-stricken beggars wearing rags who are hungry and thirsty. And then he said, he asked his disciple, Madhurnath Biswas, who was a rich man, a rich disciple, a rich devotee, who was very humble, who was ready to obey Sri Ramakrishna's instructions in total. So he asked Madhurnath Biswas to distribute food, clothing, and some other necessary items among these poor people. Madhurnath, though he was rich, was perhaps he thought it takes a long time for us to bring all these things from Calcutta, a few hundreds of kilometers away, because things were not available in huge quantities in the neighborhood. Everything will have to be brought from Calcutta. So it will be a bit difficult right now. It may take a long time. So he expressed a little reluctance. Then Sri Ramakrishna said, then I am not coming to the temple with you. I am not interested in going to these pilgrim centers. I shall sit among these people, these poor people. Unless you give them food and clothing, I won't move away from here. Then the disciple had to bring all these items all the way from Calcutta, food, clothing, etc. That was the heart of Sri Ramakrishna. But at the same time, Sri Ramakrishna could not tolerate when somebody tells him, well, I want to help the world. People are very poor, so I want to uplift them. Whenever they spoke from a sense of egotism, he could not tolerate. So he says, you are so big and the world so small that it stands in need of your help. So gospel, in a way, presents before us a complete and compact philosophy of life. When one can never read the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna leave it without receiving some ideas which will uplift his life. I shall read a few more important portions just. Then Sri Ramakrishna here refers to certain negative trends which are prevalent in those days in Calcutta. Preachers, religious teachers used to preach that this world is dark, the world is miserable, we are all sinners. Sri Ramakrishna didn't approve of this kind of teaching. Sri Ramakrishna warns us against some of the immature teachings of those who have not yet found God. He disapproved of those who always say that this world is dark, miserable place, or that it is a dense forest. So, a highly, pessimist interpretation of the world. We are all sinners, the world is miserable. So let us pray to God to save us from this misery. And a feeling of perpetual misery, unhappiness, chaos, and darkness. Sri Ramakrishna could not tolerate because that's against the fundamental teachings of Upanishads and Vedanta. He said that, on the contrary, to those who cling to God in weal and woe is a mansion of joy. Those who cling to God, why should they consider themselves to be miserable? God is all merciful, all compassionate, who listens to you, answers your prayers, fulfills your desires. And then you, on the one hand, you pray to God and then say, consider you to be the most miserable human being. If you are the most miserable human beings, you should be in hell somewhere. You should be in the camp of the devil, not with God. If you feel you are with God, then you should feel joy. You should feel happiness. You should feel yourself fortunate and lucky. So Sri Ramakrishna says, those who cling to God will find this life is a mansion of joy and happiness. So if you are a sincere devotee, you can never feel yourself miserable. Santushta satatam yogi yatatma dridhanischeha mayyarpita manobuddhi yoman bhakta samipriha. You find in the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is Bhakti Yoga, the chapter dealing with devotion. It begins a long description of the characteristics of an ideal devotee of God. And the first characteristic of an ideal devotee of God is santushtaha. He is always happy. If you feel you are with God, then you should feel happiness and joy. It's called bliss. That's what you need. If you feel you are miserable and still you claim you are a devotee of God, there is something wrong with your concept of God, or there is something wrong with your devotional practices. It's a very illuminating interpretation of true spiritual aspiration. He said that, on the contrary, to those who cling to God in weal and woe, it is a mansion of joy. So, devotion makes you feel that your sincere devotion makes you feel you are one with God. It's called, Salokya, Samipya, Sarupya, Sarshti, Sayuja. These are the five levels of evolution in bhakti philosophy according to Ramanujais and according to dualistic and qualified dualistic systems of Vedanta. First, you feel that you are in the same world with God. And then you feel you are not far from God, you are near to God. And then you feel, you have got some of the external characteristics of God, Sarupya. And if you are in the same world with God, if you are very near God, then naturally you will have some of godly characteristics. So one can never feel miserable on the one hand and at the same time be a sincere devotee of God. Sincerity of devotion gives us a sense of inner joy and happiness. That's why, on some occasions, when traveling in America, somebody pointed out Swamiji, "Swamiji, you are always happy and joyful. How is it that?" So maybe that devotee expected Swamiji to be always grim-faced with a serious expression on his face and no-nonsense attitude towards everything. That's what he possibly expected, because a spiritual teacher should be grim, serious, a most uncompromising expression always on his face. But actually a sincere devotee, a real devotee, will have a sense of joy. It is not carefree expression of joy. Rather, it is an expression of the inner feeling of bliss. And bliss is a word, in fact, its Sanskrit equivalent is ananda. It is something which one can never really define or describe, but can only be experienced. So, Sri Ramakrishna, he used to refer to some of the preachers of popular religions in Calcutta. Some of the preachers of the Church of England, Anglican Church, and Brahma Samaj devotees, the followers of Raja Ramamohan Roy and Kesava Chandra Sen, because they took much of their teachings from the Unitarian Church. So they also used to stand on street corners and preach, "You terrible sinners, you miserable wretches," almost like, the language of John the Baptist in New Testament. You vipers and sinners and snakes, such expressions. Brahma Samaj and this, some of these preachers used to do. So Sri Ramakrishna doesn't approve. He was himself a great, he was a great lover of Jesus. Sri Ramakrishna himself greatly appreciated the spiritual teachings of Jesus Christ elsewhere. But he says he doesn't approve of the interpretation of true religion, calling human beings as sinners and miserable wretches. So he says, and this was practiced by Brahma Samaj preachers also. So he says, constant harping on the idea that we are weak, miserable sinners. Sri Ramakrishna, no, you are not right. If you are a true devotee of God, you should consider yourself to be fortunate. And that feeling of inner joy will give you a kind of contentment and satisfaction. So Gita says, santushtaka. He's always happy. Santosha, this kind of bliss is defined not in terms of material satisfaction, but rather, if you feel a kind of joy and contentment, you feel that there is nothing more to be sought after, nothing more to be gained, nothing more to be aspired for. A sense of complete inner contentment. That's what comes to any true, sincere devotee of God, no matter whatever religion he practices. No matter whatever religion he practices. If you feel that God is looking after you, why should you feel miserable, wretched, and unhappy, and unfortunate? It's an insult to God. You say you are a devotee of God and you think you are very unfortunate. If you are a devotee of God, you should consider yourself to be fortunate. That's what Sri Ramakrishna means here. So many of these teachings are unique and universal in their interpretation and also in their approach towards the spiritual problems of modern man. Now, Sri Ramakrishna also sometimes addresses different types of devotees. He says there are devotees of different types. There are those who are of a highly evolved type. He calls them sattvic devotees. They may practice their religious, spiritual, they may do their spiritual practice in their room without the knowledge of others. They may not parade their piety, their devotion to others. The man who worships from the very depth of his heart without the least ostentation or vanity is a sattvic worshipper. It means a devotee of a superior type without any external exhibition of piety or devotion. Because if you exhibit your devotion, there is something wrong with you. You not only want God, but also you want others to know that you are a devotee of God. So he's a devotee, no doubt, but he's not devotee of the highest type. That's what Sri Ramakrishna means here. The man who gives much attention to decorating his house, makes much fuss about music and dance, makes all costly and elaborate arrangements for a rich feast when celebrating the worship of the deity, is a rajasic worshipper. From an individual point of view, says, there are some people, you know, who even in informal conversation, they will say, no, it is time for me to meditate, so I'm going to meditate. I mean, this man is a devotee, no doubt, but he belongs to the second category of devotees. That's what Sri Ramakrishna means. The man who immolates hundreds of innocent gods in sleep on the altar, that's another kind of. There are some devotees who perform elaborate rituals, very often bringing misery and unhappiness to others, sometimes even sacrificing animals, as they used to do in ancient religious traditions. You know. He considers them as devotees belonging to the third category of the lowest type. And he also quotes from Srimad Bhagavata. I should conclude now. Its time is up. He also speaks of three types of devotees, quoting from the 11th book of the great devotional work called Bhagavata. He says, the highest type of devotees are those who experiences the presence of God in every living being in this world. They don't make a distinction between the creator and creation. So sarvabhudeshu yapasyet bhagavat bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavati atmani esa bhagavatottamaha. Bhagavata Purana says the highest devotee is one who feels and experiences the presence of the divine in the divine spark in every living being in this world, not only in human beings but also in entire creation. It is not pantheism, it is not natural worship, not equating God with nature, but means if the creation is a creation of God, the creation is also sacred. If the creation is a creation of God, God creates this world out of his compassion for mankind. In that case, whatever he creates, whatever is associated with God, is sacred. So, there is ultimately no distinction between the sacred or spiritual and secular. Everything is sacred. And the devotee of the highest type spiritualizes his whole life. Every act becomes an act of worship. Every thought becomes an act of meditation. And his whole life becomes spiritual life. That's what Sri Ramakrishna says. This he prescribes to different aspirants depending upon their temperament. Sri Ramakrishna doesn't give the same teaching to all. Not that he discriminates. But he knows that all teachings are not meant for all people. So first he listens to the aspirants. He judges, he measures, and he understands where the devotee stands. And then he instructs him so that he could lift him to the next point of spiritual evolution. See, a man like Girishchandra Ghosh, who was a drunkard, Sri Ramakrishna doesn't teach Advaita philosophy to him, not at all. He tells him, you try to take the name of God at least once a day. And when you get up and when you go to sleep. But Girishchandra Ghosh is, most of the time he's unconscious. He's a drunkard. So he tells him, well, in that case, you sincerely believe that you have handed over the responsibility of your spiritual life to me. Sri Ramakrishna understood, this man is sincere, truthful, though he led a carefree life, bohemian life. And that helped him. From that moment onwards, it became physically and mentally impossible for Girishchandra Ghosh to do anything wrong. A man like Narendra Datta, a highly qualified spiritual aspirant who later became Swami Vivekananda, he taught him Advaita. The chronicler of the gospel, Mahendranath Gupta, who actually left his home at 10 o'clock and reached his nephew's home near Dakshineswar, the house of Siddheshwar Majumdar, had decided to commit suicide. And that man came to Dakshineswar the next day evening on a Sunday and met Sri Ramakrishna. He felt there is something wonderful about this man. He was attracted. And gradually he started coming regularly and he became one of the greatest householder devotees of Sri Ramakrishna, the chronicler of the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. He wanted to practice Advaita because he was of an intellectual temperament. But Sri Ramakrishna asked him to practice the path of devotion. So he knew where the devotee stood, where the aspirant belonged. And according to his needs, according to his requirements, according to his immediate needs and requirements, Sri Ramakrishna gave him appropriate spiritual instruction, which transformed him. In the case of Girishchandra Ghosh, he became a great saint. From a sinner, he became a saint. In the case of Swami Vivekananda, Narendra Datta, he was an agnostic. He was a great intellectual who led a pure life. He was a spiritual aspirant right from his infancy. But he was not sure in which way to turn. For some time he experimented with Brahma Samaj teachings. Then he practiced some of the spiritual sadhanas. But ultimately he came to Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna insisted to him that he should practice Advaita sadhana. Like that. So, a highly positive approach. His approach was essentially humanistic, universal, and he never closes his doors and windows before spiritualized parents. So, in a way, the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is universal. In a way, it belongs to the entire mankind. It doesn't belong to any particular religious tradition or a particular country. It is perhaps a religious scripture of the whole mankind in the truly universalistic sense, because it can be approached, studied, and one can be benefited by reading it. It's possible for not only believers, but also even unbelievers also. So, time is up. I'm concluding. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Sthapakaya Cha Dharmasya Sarva Dharmasya Rupini Avatara Varishthaya Ramakrishnaya Te Namaha.